Real quick. No, I'm joking. The court calls the United States v. Quinn, counsel for the government.
Morning, Chief Judge Baker, your honors, and may it please the court. I'm Lieutenant James Belforti, and along with Colonel Mark Jamison, I represent the United States in this matter. With your permission, Chief Judge Baker, I'd like to request to reserve 3 minutes of my time for rebuttal.
Granted.
Thank you, Your Honor. Congress did not grant the Courts of Criminal Appeals authority to order sentence-only rehearings, and the Supreme Court recognized this fact in Jackson v. Taylor. Despite this, the Miller Court found this power to exist by rewriting Article 66D, changing the phrase "the findings and sentence" to read "the findings or sentence." This error continues to exist in this Court's jurisprudence, and this Court should take this opportunity to correct it here today.
But didn't they specifically go in and explain why they thought they could do what they did after the Supreme Court's decision in Jackson?
The Miller Court, Your Honor?
Yes.
Well, the court had different reasonings for it, but at the end of the day, they said, in order to read it this way, we have to change the reading of it from "and" to "or," to avoid what they considered to be an unlikely intention of Congress.
But they did reference the Supreme Court's ruling and explained that they thought they were talking about what the Court of Military Appeals had held in Keith, and that was the route the Supreme Court was going down. So they were just looking at it, if you read the opinion, from a different perspective than the government does today.
Well, Your Honor, they did reference the Supreme Court decision in Jackson v. Taylor, but they ignored the portion of the decision that spoke quite plainly. We find no authority in the Uniform Code of Military Justice for such a procedure, and no one can point to any. So though the Miller Court did say, well, we find that the Supreme Court was merely observing that there are some difficulties in ordering sentence rehearings, that's not actually what the Supreme Court was saying, Your Honor. So when evaluating this issue, the key phrase in Article 66D, as actually pointed out by the Miller Court, is "the findings and sentence." That phrase, which uses the conjunctive "and" as opposed to the disjunctive "or," creates an integrated whole consisting of both parts of the case. Thus, the Courts of Criminal Appeals cannot order a sentence-only rehearing the way other actors under the Code can.
In Quintanilla, the Navy took a different view, as I'm sure you're aware. In Quintanilla, the petitioner filed a petition for reconsideration and said, and this was a death penalty case, and said, in essence, under the military justice system, I'm entitled to a rehearing on findings and sentence rather than just on sentences as has been ordered by the CCA. And the Navy took the view, and I quote from its filing, "Petitioner's suggestion is at odds with established case law and would lead to an obviously absurd result." So the Navy took a different view in 2006 than it took today. So my question is, why would it be absurd then but not now?
Your Honor, I think under
this is in a death penalty case, I might note.
This is not a death penalty case, Your Honor.
And in that case then went on to the Supreme Court that denied cert.
Yes,
I understand cert's not precedent, but the Supreme Court, in theory, is familiar with its own case law that you're relying on.
Yes, Your Honor.
So is it the government's view that Quintanilla was entitled to a rehearing on findings as well as on sentencing?
Your Honor, I don't – the word entitled trips me up there. I don't think he was necessarily entitled. I think that – I would agree that – our position here today is at odds with this court's precedent, and we wouldn't run away from that fact.
And at odds with the Navy's position in Quintanilla.
For that particular case, yes.
So here's a question that I have for you, which is the whole issue of stare decisis, right? You would presume, I mean, before you even get to that doctrine, there's a presumption that there was an error, right?
Yes, sir.
Right? So let's assume that we were wrong in Miller, and we've been wrong for decades. What counsels for adopting your position in light of stare decisis? I mean, this is a statutory provision; it's not the Constitution. Why would we change? I mean, I'll assume we're wrong, right? I think, and I said in our last case that I thought that we were wrong.
Well, Your Honor, I think any time we're in the military context, which we're obviously in here today, any time any actor under the UCMJ is operating outside of its congressional dictates, we're getting into a situation where the courts in this case are taking power unto themselves that was not granted to them. And I think that creates a I don't want to say structural because that's a term of art, but it creates a conflict in the way the balance of powers are supposed to work, particularly in the military context, because in the military context, all
what about
the
president's recognition of sentencing-only rehearings and the rules for court-martial? You're saying courts have usurped this to themselves, but the president has at least affirmed it, if not independently provided authority pursuant to Article 36.
Well, Your Honor, the president
I jumped in on your question, so.
That's, well, I'm assuming he's going to answer my question.
Okay. You're not off the hook on that. I'm piling on.
I know you are. With regards to the rules for court-martial, I mean, obviously, because this is the way it's been interpreted by this court and the inferior courts for the better part of several decades, obviously the rules are going to reflect that there are such a thing.
But I'm responding to your comment that this is somehow courts usurping the authority of the political branches, and I'm just pointing out that at least one of the political branches, depending on whether you agree with the government's view or not, but at minimum one of the political branches, the president, has expressly adopted the sentence rehearing as a possibility. He could have done otherwise. He could have said the Miller court's nuts. Why would I put that rule of court-martial in the book? But instead he said, I'm putting the rule of court-martial in the book.
Well, sir, there is such a thing as sentence-only rehearings within the code. It's just whether or not the courts of criminal appeals have the ability to order them. So it's not that there's no such thing as a sentence-only rehearing. It's just that, and I recognize that.
The president did not so delimit it, and nor did the legislative history so delimit it when the general counsel of DOD was testifying before the Congress for the 1982 Military Justice Reform Act.
That's true that the counsel did testify that way, Your Honor, but I would point to the actual words that are in the statute. And the premise from that argument about the legislative history is that basically the Congress intended to take the authority under 66D and just apply it to the judge advocates general pursuant to Article 69C. The problem with that is Article 69C doesn't mirror the exact language of Article 66D. It actually uses the language that the Miller Court adopted and uses the phrase the findings or sentence as opposed to the findings and sentence. Now, it's possible to say, well, that just means that they thought that the Miller Court got it right and therefore we're reasserting that. The problem is they didn't subsequently adjust 66D to read correctly, findings or sentence.
Okay. So that Counsel, when you're done with this, will you go back to
my question?
Yeah,
I'm about to spend you back.
Because this is going on and on. And in Winkleman, right, I agree with Judge Stuckey, right, that the court had misread the Supreme Court's decision when we decided Miller. Okay, I mean, right, I said that clearly.
Yes,
sir. And
then
I said, well, no one's asked us to revisit it, but then there was another part to my question, or explained why principles of stare decisis would counsel for us to change the rule back to what the Supreme Court said.
Once again, Your Honor, I think.
So let's say I completely agree with you, got it wrong, statutory analysis cuts both ways, but, you know, we got it wrong, based on Supreme Court precedent, okay?
But we've been wrong. Since 1959, everybody's been doing it one way.
And so explain then why, given that this is not a constitutional issue, right, it's a statutory interpretation issue, explain why it's unworkable, something else has changed, intervening circumstances. What is it, other than two judges saying in Wilkinson, yeah, we think that you're right, it was decided incorrectly. What other than that fact counsels for us to decide it the way you would like us to?
Well, I think like the factors I highlighted from Citizens United, which I agree with the appellee that is a constitutional case, but I don't think those factors should be limited to only constitutional precedent. But it was wrongly decided. It wasn't.
To be wrongly decided for you even to get to stare decisis, right?
I mean, that's true, Your Honor. But I would point out that there are no reliance interests in the way that they were talked about in Citizens United, where there's some sort of contract interest or something that people are, you know, the only reliance interest one could argue is that someone was pleading guilty on the thought that if for some reason it was overturned, it would get sent back down. That's not a, the kind
of... Well, how is it proved unworkable?
Your Honor, it's... Unworkable is a tough term for the military system, because if we're given orders, we're going to comply with them. We're going to find a way to get the job done. It's not efficient. It's not a good way to operate. To say it's unworkable in the sense that there's absolutely no way this can be accomplished, I think ignores...
Well, you could say it's unworkable because you could say it's not highly efficient and there's like 3,000 of them required a year and it costs us $10 billion. So look at it in that frame, unworkable in those sorts of terms.
Well, Your Honor, I don't have the raw numbers for you to say how many are there a year, but we can notice that, as this court pointed out in Winkleman, I mean, it threatens finality, it costs time, it costs money, it pulls people away from their mission. The ultimate mission of the military is to fight and win wars, and when we're taking people away in order to have sentence rehearings 3, 4, 5 years after the fact, particularly this case is a good example where someone received a 6-month sentence. The only difference was 13 years to 12 years in terms of confinement exposure, and now we're going to send it back down several years later for, you know, a sentence rehearing that could have easily been dealt with by the courts of criminal appeals.
Well, but to counter that, it seems to me, at least from the perspective of the cases that I see, that it's far more common for the CCA to reassess the sentence than to conduct a sentence rehearing, and then when it does so, only when it feels like the sentencing landscape has changed dramatically and it doesn't feel confident that it could guess, right, at what the panel would have given them.
Yes, Your Honor. But
so there's a fairness aspect to it, right?
There's a fairness aspect to it, but I would say that right now, and I pointed this out in my brief, a good case by comparison is the Pierce case that came out of the Service Corps of the Navy, where there was a much different change in the sentencing landscape, and it was the same exact sentence of 6 months, and they found that not to be a dramatic change. So if it's being done arbitrarily, which it is being done, at least in our inferior court, then that is showing that it's somewhat unworkable, that courts are applying this in different ways and in different contexts, and that's not a proper way to address even that fairness concern, Your Honor.
Counsel,
since the Supreme...
Go ahead.
We got Judge Stuckey, then Judge Erdman, yeah, and then
isn't
anybody else.
Isn't that what the Supreme Court said in Jackson v. Taylor?
Yes, sir.
That it's not workable. That you know, everything's going to be, by the time it gets back down there, it's going to be dispersed. And so, you know, Congress intended for the the boards of review.
Yes, sir.
To do the reassessment job because they were better suited for it, and they wrote it into the statute.
Exactly, Your Honor. It dealt with an interest that was effectuated via that statute. And that statute hasn't changed in any substantive way up until this day, and that was the interest that Congress was looking to vindicate. Said to do it on a national basis, to make it more equitable, to make it more efficient. So that is something that Congress wanted to accomplish.
Counsel, since Miller, we have looked at this issue a number of times. We have recognized the authority of the CCAs to order rehearings. We have specifically affirmed it on a couple of occasions. A lot of the arguments that you're making today have come up before us before. And one of the reasons for stare decisis is that if there is a problem with a judicial interpretation of the statute, Congress can change that. You can go to Congress and say, look, this has been up several times, it hasn't changed, this is not what you intended, we want you to straighten it out. Have you gone to Congress since Miller? Have you asked Congress to change that statute?
The Department of the Navy has not specifically gone to Congress.
Has DOD gone?
Represent the United States or the Department of the Navy?
I represent the United States, Your Honor. I can't speak to that specifically. I don't have any information to suggest that we have.
And don't you think that under the stare decisis rationale, don't you think that's the more appropriate way to do it, given the history of this court over the years on this particular issue?
Not in this context, Your Honor, and it's because of what the court did in Miller, how forthright it was about what it was doing in rewriting the statute, and the fact that Congress hasn't taken them up on that. Congress has dealt with the UCMJ several times since then. They've dealt with this specific authority and granted it specifically with the different words to other actors, but it hasn't modified Article 66D. So I think you're right. There are stare decisis concerns, but I think because of the nature of this case, and because of the error of the Miller court in being pretty straightforward about just saying, we're rewriting the statute, this is not the proper way to read it.
Well, and put yourself in the shoes of Congress. What is Congress supposed to do? Congress wrote a statute, and it's got a Supreme Court decision saying, yeah, Congress meant what it said in the statute. What is Congress supposed to now do? Say, you know, the Court of Military Appeals is screwed up and put it in statute?
No, exactly, Your Honor. And because all the authority under the UCMJ emanates from Congress, when they've already granted the power in a certain way, they don't have to go further to correct an incorrect interpretation of it, especially when they've used
Did
different
Did they grant
words.
The president the power to make rules and procedural rules?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, and did he provide for sentence rehearing?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. What are the ramifications of your position? Would someone like Quintanilla be entitled to a writ of quorum nobis, since in accord with your position, he would have been resentenced in a context where there was no jurisdiction? So he'd be entitled to a writ of quorum nobis, would he not?
Your Honor, I'm not following the
question. Well, he was resentenced at a sentence-only rehearing. And yes, the government's view is that there is no such thing as a sentence-only rehearing. So that's ultra vires, right? There's no jurisdiction for that.
Well,
so presumably anybody who's been sentenced at a sentence-only rehearing ordered by the CCA would have been sentenced by an entity that had no authority to so do.
Yes,
right?
Sir.
That's a structural error.
Yes,
so presumably
sir.
All those people would be entitled to a writ of quorum nobis to have a proper findings and sentence rehearing in accord with the government, which leads to why doesn't stare decisis therefore argue in favor of holding the law where it is rather than having all those cases come back to revisit?
Well, Your Honor, I mean, the courts of criminal appeals were operating properly under this court's authority when they never had the authority. But the problem is, for example, Sills is a good example where the Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals affirmatively overturned this court, which it doesn't have the authority to do, and that's not the proper way to do it, just in the same way that this court doesn't have the authority to overturn the Supreme Court. So to say that, well, they were doing it improperly, yes, but they were operating within the dictates of
their
own
rules. But you just argued this court can't create law or jurisdiction that doesn't exist. But now you're saying we can, but it was just wrong to do it.
No, Your Honor, I'm not saying that this court can create jurisdiction that doesn't exist. I'm saying that the CCAs were not acting illegally from a procedural perspective because they don't have the authority to overturn this court's rulings. And the United States isn't asking for this to apply retroactively.
But you can't choose that if it's a structural error, right? If Quintanilla was sentenced and had a sentence-only rehearing, and you're arguing there was no jurisdiction to do that, he's entitled to have a findings and sentence rehearing. You can't say we don't want this to apply retroactively if it's structural.
The findings and sentence rehearing, and I'm departing somewhat from Quintanilla, but it only comes up if you're setting aside the findings and saying we need to order a rehearing on the findings and the sentence. CCA could have also said, okay, we've set aside this finding. We don't feel that it's necessary to order a rehearing on that finding, and we're going to reassess that sentence. So it's not necessarily in every case where a rehearing on sentence has been ordered that someone would have standing to come back and ask for a writ of quorum nobis.
Thank you, counsel. Any further questions? Thank you for addressing all the questions. Counsel, for the appellee.
Good morning, Chief Judge Baker, and may it please the court. My name is Captain David Peters, and I represent Sergeant Christopher Quick. After setting aside one of Sergeant Quick's convictions, the lower court determined that it could not reliably reassess his sentence, so it remanded to the convening authority for a rehearing on sentencing authorized. The government now contends that this procedure was improper, but their argument's wrong for three reasons. First, the plain language of Article 66D has always authorized courts of criminal appeal to remand for sentence-only rehearings. Second, the Supreme Court's holding in Jackson versus Taylor addressed a different issue than that presently before the court. And third, no intervening development in the law has weakened the essential holding of United States versus Miller, expressed most relevantly in United States versus Sills, or rendered either of those decisions irreconcilable with competing legal interests. Therefore, they're entitled to adherence as a matter of stare decisis in statutory interpretation. Now, if this court agrees with any of those three conclusions, the government's argument must fail. If it agrees with all three of those conclusions, however, it should regard the government's argument as an invitation to invade Congress's legislative supremacy and change Article 66D where Congress has repeatedly declined to do so. Turning first to the plain language of Article 66D, neither the Supreme Court nor this court have specifically applied 1 U.S.C. 1, but this court should do so now because it renders the entire...
That's the argument the government made in Janssen. We've got a magic housekeeping statute over here that will fix whatever problems we've got. That may be the case, other things being equal. But other things aren't equal in this case because you've got a Supreme Court holding on point.
Your Honor, turning to the holding of Jackson versus Taylor, as appellant pointed out, there is some disagreement as to whether the relevant portion for our purposes here is either holding or dicta. This court's predecessor in Miller found that it was dicta and chose not to be bound by it.
You parse Supreme Court decisions as a lower court at your peril. Go ahead.
There's good evidence in the procedural history of Jackson, Your Honor, that supports the court's military appeals decision not to be bound by that language. There are several factors. The first, and I think the most relevant.
Well, but what happened to 1 U.S.C. 1?
Well, Your Honor, I'm happy to return to 1 U.S.C. 1, and if we apply it to the facts of this case, we have three findings of guilty, one of which was set aside. Court of Criminal Appeals determined that it could not reliably reassess the sentence. So, if we look to the plain meaning of Article 66D, the phrase, the findings in the sentence, that trigger of discretion, in fact, occurred here. The findings in that one finding among three was set aside, along with the sentence. So, the lower court was within its discretion to order the rehearing that it did. There's no contextual reason or grammatical reason to limit the meaning of the word rehearing to one that is essentially a retrial.
Except that the Supreme Court held differently.
Your Honor, the Supreme Court never addressed the meaning of the word rehearing specifically in their opinion.
It didn't have to. It said there is no power.
Yes, Your Honor, they did say that. However, I think, again, it's important to look at what question the Supreme Court was being asked to answer.
It was being asked to construe the powers of the boards of review.
Yes, Your Honor, it was.
And it did.
It was being asked to construe the powers of the boards of review within the context of whether they had the authority to reassess on their own or whether they were, in fact, required to remand for a sentence-only rehearing. That was the question that in fact, led to the case coming before the Supreme Court in the first place. It came as a result of a circuit split between the Third and the Seventh Circuits. The Third Circuit held that in reviewing Jackson's case that the Board of Review did have that authority to reassess on their own, whereas the Seventh Circuit in reviewing DeCoster's case found that they didn't have that authority. And that was the question presented before the Supreme Court in Jackson, which is supported by the question presented in the Solicitor General's brief, which is found in the Joint Appendix at 96. So, if we consider that that's how the Supreme Court came to hear the case in the first place, that was the question they were asked to answer, and that entire portion of the Jackson decision related to that the government relies on could be removed, and the question presented would still have been answered, that portends strongly in favor of the Court of Military Appeals' decision not to be bound by that language. So
it's your position that the Supreme Court, having been asked a question as to the powers of the boards of review, by answering the question saying not only do they have this power, but nobody else has this power, and it's to be exercised this way, somehow went outside what it was asked? Go ahead.
Yes, Your Honor. In fact, I am. I think that's supported by not only the procedural history I just described, I think it's also supported by the judge's understanding when they were at oral argument and the counsel's understanding when they were at oral argument at several points in describing their position. Counsels for the appellants in that case described themselves as saying, the issue presently before us is whether the Board of Review in fact, has this authority in the first place, and assuming that they do not.
Okay, and so the Supreme Court proceeded to answer that question and a question implicit in it. How is that illegitimate?
Your Honor, I don't necessarily agree that the question is implicit in what they had before them. What they, in fact, had before them was a specific authority of the Board of Review. Whether they could, in fact, reassess this on their own or if they had a required outcome by the dictates of Article 66D. What the Supreme Court read into the statute was that, in fact, the discretion that they have for the use of the permissive may was that they could reassess it on their own, and that was supported by the legislative history of the code at that point. So I don't believe that they're... I believe they are related but separate questions. So again, if we look to... If we take that understanding and look back to the plain language of the statute, all of the necessary triggers, when the statute's observed through the language of 1 U.S.C. 1, all the necessary triggers are met for the court to order a rehearing as to the sentence. Now, the government points to other portions of the statute where the word rehearing is modified by language of limitation or language of explanation, such as in Article 60, where they discuss a rehearing for findings or a rehearing for sentencing. The fact that the word rehearing is then followed by a modifier isn't suggestive of the ambiguity in the word rehearing. Rather, it's suggestive of that word's of the depth of meaning that that word, in fact, has within the context of the entire code. So a rehearing, if one can be ordered for findings and one can be ordered for sentencing, it follows logically that rehearing, when not accompanied by any kind of explanation or language limitation, be one that could apply to both findings and sentence. And this is further supported by the fact that we have a bifurcated process for courts martial. We have a hearing on the findings, the trial portion, and we have a hearing on the sentencing portion. And then to turn to the issue of stare decisis, Citizens United is an incongruous case for what we have before us today. Citizens United is a case that deals with the Supreme Court's interpretation of the First Amendment as extending to the free speech rights of corporations. We have nothing even close to that. We have a matter of statutory interpretation before us today. This court's predecessor and this court for more than 60 years now has interpreted Article 66D as permitting sentencing rehearings. If they find an error which affects both the findings and the sentence, they are allowed to remand for sentencing rehearings. So the test is, in fact, whether there is an intervening development in the law which renders that previous opinion irreconcilable with competing legal interests, or if that holding has somehow been undermined by a subsequent decision. And we find that in the Supreme Court's decision in Neal versus United States. The government has offered no explanation beyond the inconvenience that it experiences when it has to do sentencing-only rehearings as to why we should turn away from that standard. And that just simply isn't up to the task that Neal requires. So with that in mind, there's just simply no reason for this court to now turn away from it. The government just simply hasn't made that argument. They haven't presented a legal reason, they presented logistical ones. And I would also suggest that it is equally difficult and logistically hard when a court of criminal appeals sets aside the entirety of findings and an appellant is sent back for a rehearing that is, in fact, a new court-martial, a retrial. But we don't hear the same complaints about the logistical difficulties then, and that's suggestive of the fact that they're picking and choosing when they choose to be logistically encumbered and when they don't. If there are no further questions, that concludes my argument.
Here's there are no further questions. Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the government, you have the opportunity for a rebuttal.
I just want to make three quick rebuttal points to the appellee's argument. First, the issue about the question presented in Jackson versus Taylor about whether or not the boards of review have the authority to answer it. I mean, they answered the question saying, yeah, and here's why. Because you have the authority in this section, and you don't have the authority to do this other proceeding, which is the only other proceeding that could vindicate this interest. To say that that's dicta simply because it's not answering the question, I think doesn't quite grasp the nature of the question.
Can you speak to the issue of the intervening change in the law, which is distinct from the intervening change in the composition of this court, okay? Because that's part of the stare decisis, the reason for stare decisis. I'm thinking of, for example, in the Article 134 context, right? Obviously, the requirement that it be pleaded and proven, was a change, but that was based both on intervening Supreme Court decisions, right? Apprendi, et cetera, et cetera. And it was a constitutional issue. It was an issue of constitutional magnitude, not just a statutory interpretation. So show me or explain to me the same sorts of things that arise in the context of this particular issue.
Your Honor, I would point to the changes in the authority given to the judge advocates general and the convening authorities under the code. So prior to Miller...
Didn't they get that authority? Wasn't the reason for it so that they could have the same authority as the CCAs had?
No, Your Honor, because when we actually look at the... I would say this. First, similar authority is not the exact, is not identical authority. Secondly, at the time of the 1983, the Military Justice Act of 1983, Judge Advocate General didn't have the authority to order any kind of rehearing. So to say we want them to have similar powers as the courts of criminal appeals is just saying, yeah, we want the JAGs to be able to order rehearings the way that we wanted the courts of criminal appeals to order rehearings. And I think the final point on that is that if they wanted to have the identical powers, one, they would have said that in the legislative history. Two, they would have used the identical words. Or they would have used the words that they use in Article 69C and then modified 66D so that it works as an integrated system. So I think to say, well, the reason they wanted it is because they wanted them to be able to order sentence-only rehearings, I think that's broadening the legislative history beyond what it stands for, Your Honor. And, Your Honor, with regards to Appellee's position about the words of explanation with regards to rehearings, that would render large sections of the Uniform Code of Military Justice as surplusage, which we shouldn't do here. And finally, with regard to the point about logistical difficulties about full rehearings, the reason we're not complaining about logistical difficulties about full rehearings is because that authority is specifically granted to the courts of criminal appeals. So Congress gets to decide about the logistical difficulties, not us. Thank you. That concludes my argument.
Thank you, counsel. The court thanks both counsel, and we stand in recess until further order of the court, which may not be till the fall. Anyway, thank you very much.